tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa Aparuta de sangamatasa tavara ye sorvanta bamunjantu sadang. Observance night, and they have about 3 weeks left of the winter's retreat, and then 11th in the 2 week intensive. What does that do? Formal community retreat. Whatever terms you want to put it, but what I'm pointing to is more or less how you hold these perceptions, rather than the retreat itself, or having views and opinions about how it should or shouldn't be, because there's awareness. Allows us to awaken to how things impinge on us, how they affect us in the immediate present. It's not based on ideals about how you should think or feel or how things should be, but on the way they are. As I remember in Thailand, the idea of the Kalpansa and the rains retreat, and used to think immediately I say Kalpansa entering the rains retreat, and then I'd immediately plan all these things, ways of doing something, having to practice really hard and fast. I'd go on fasts, and I'd do the sitter's practice, and do all these kind of ascetic things. Where one year I was a strict vegetarian. I aditan to be a vegetarian the whole year, and it wasn't easy in Thailand, where they in a monastery where most of the things they cook or give are in served with this fish sauce, so they're salty. Fish sauce, nam pla, and I'm so strict that I was having trouble finding food to eat. And then I get very obsessed with the food that was available, that it was pure vegetarian. I'd get into a real snit about that, thinking I deserved a lot of that, and when I didn't get the amount that I thought I deserved, I'd get really angry and upset towards some of the monks who I thought were making fun of me, or I'd project all kinds of evil intentions on their side. So being strict vegetarian brought out a real nasty streak in me, actually. Because I was respecting the life of animals, but in the process, I was really creating incredible tensions in my mind because of the way I held vegetarianism. And then I'd also think, I started looking down on the ones, see them eating drumstick, a chicken leg, or fish or something, corpse-eating bhikkhus. They like to eat corpses. They're like ghouls. They live off dead animals. And I became a bit snooty too, and looked down on meat-eating monks. But then through the process, because the point was always this mindfulness, then I began to see it was the way I was holding these things. You know, vegetarianism, I could hold it in a very strict puritanical way, very inflexible, and that because it made me feel, it could make me feel superior also. That somehow I was, you know, a bit above the rest. I noticed just the way of feeling better than the rest, feeling that I'm somehow better monk or more serious or more pure. Just by observing that feeling of being better than, I could see, was not a pleasant perception to hold, to operate from, to experience life through the idea that somehow I'm better than somebody else. Or retreats, 2-week formal retreat. Well, formal, what does that mean? And even the word retreat. Remember, some in the retreats we used to give 10 years ago, a very strict noble silence, and where you had to really, you know, sit 1 hour, walk 1 hour, sit 1 hour, walk 1 hour, and meet at 4 in the morning and leave at 11 at night, and really push people into this. And then, of course, it became a tremendous... Some people loved it. Some people love that kind of thing. Other people hate it. So... You know, that's just the way it is. You can't say everyone should love it, or that there's something even wrong with it to do it that way. But how we, you know, just learning to use the conditions that we have that affect us, so that we begin to see them, how the words we use, or the tone of voice, the attitude, the perceptions we create is like this. And then you're looking, you can look here, you know. There's no way you should feel about it, or right view that if you were really proper monk or nun that you would be feeling. But even if you feel totally kind of shattered by the idea of another month of retreat, being aware of that is developing the path. Path is not that difficult if you trust in the awareness rather than in some idea you have about practice or retreats or monasticism or whatever. This retreat this winter has been, you know, encouraging and kind of trying to encourage you to have a trust in a kind of continuous awareness of how what you are, what are your emotional reactions or feelings, attitudes, assumptions, projections that we have that arise during this time. Then the attitude of welcoming. I find this is my path, a way of welcoming, because it allows me to welcome that which I don't like or don't want to see or don't want to know or try to control or resist. Because in meditation, of course, there's going to be, you're opening the doors to the deathless. The gates to the deathless are open. It's like Pandora's box, isn't it? You open the box, everything flies out. So what comes out, you know, is isn't maybe what you expect. You know, when I first became started meditation, I just wanted to attain samadhi and have peaceful, tranquil states. And my practice was aimed always at trying to get very peaceful and tranquil. And so one time I just, I did about my third lesson of meditation. This was as a layman, Wat Maha Thak, in Bangkok. I was teaching at the Thammasat University in the morning, teaching English, and I'd go over to Section 5, Wat Maha Thak, in the afternoon. Third lesson, Thursday afternoon, I went over. It was pretty, the first two lessons were, you know, I was trying, but I wasn't getting anything from it. It was just pain in the knees and the heat and then just thinking, well, you know, you've got to bear with this and it'll take time, keep going at it, and it'll bear good results. And then the third lesson, I sat down, some monk opened the door and banged it shut, and I went into a state of absolute bliss. And I knew everything. I was completely enlightened at that moment. And I never experienced such a beautiful kind of blissful state. I sat there, timeless. Didn't want to go anywhere. Just stayed in this state of bliss and savored it. And thought, you're doing pretty good. Three lessons, you're there. You're a natural arahant, Tomato. Or Robert, as the name was then. So the next day I looked forward to going back and doing that again. And the fourth day it was utter hell because nobody banged a door. And and if they did, it didn't work this time, and I just sat there with sore knees and heat and remembering the previous day, holding that and wanting to have it again. Think, how can I get that? I want that. Whereas the third day when the samadhi took place spontaneously, there was no expectation. You know, I had no memory of having such a state, so it just happened. Then in practicing, of course, one does get these very blissful states, and then the memory, one holds on to wanting them again. So remember, anything pleasant is addictive. Even pleasant memories, holding on to memories of previous retreats and of previous samadhis and previous great moments of insight and sitting here now trying to practice in order to get something that you remember doesn't work. Because that very attitude, you're holding it the wrong way. You're trying to get something through remembering previously, something that happened before. Or like Nibbana, the word Nibbana, they call it the highest happiness, and then it's a very difficult remote possibility. This is generally what I picked up when I first started meditation in Thailand, was that, you know, it's very difficult to attain nibbana, and very few ever do it. It is very high and very special. And then one monk told me, don't ever try to get nibbana, you know, just get rid of the word. Don't use it even. And others said that nobody could attain nibbana these days. Those days, time of the Buddha, was a different time, different place. And the people were much more pure in those days. They're not all complicated, neurotic, and screwed up like we are. And so then, these are attitudes about a word. Nibbana is only a word. N-I-B-B-A-N-A. And yet one can create a whole scenario around that word. It's very precious, very difficult to attain. Only, you know, there's a few that you might get, you know, like, is Buddhadasa, is he an arahant? This was the big question among the expatriates into Buddhist meditation in Bangkok, 1966. And some said, yes, Buddhadasa is an arahant. Another said, no, he's not. He's not even a Sotapanna. And there were strong views from people that didn't know anything what they were talking about, basically. But because they maybe had read the scriptures in some way. But even you can't trust your reading of the scriptures. Remember how the biases that we carry from our own cultural mindset, how we interpret the Pali Canon, how we resonate with these words is you can't trust it. So this is where this trusting in awakened awareness rather than in views, opinions, concepts, doctrines about anything, about Theravada, Pali Canon, various teachers, methods, views about other forms of Buddhism or other religions. So remember, these are viewpoints, conditions, out of ignorance. Avijja is the cause of dukkha. So then the message is, wake up, pay attention, present here and now. And when we chant the qualities of the Dhamma, apparent here and now, timeless, encouraging investigation, leading onward to be experienced individually by the wise. So, if nibbana, if there is such a thing, whatever that is, if you think about it in terms of your conceptual mind, what happens? It's something you're planning to get in the future if you practice hard. Sit for hours, concentrate your mind, control everything, go on fast, be vegetarian, do all the right things, and any bad thoughts you extirpate immediately, you get rid of. And you develop good thoughts, and on all the advice of how to practice in order to attain nibbana. So then the conundrum or the mystery of it all, isn't it? The thing that you can't reason out or figure out with your conceiving mind is that it is very apparent here and now. Timeless. come and see. And then ehi pasiko is like, it's almost an invitation. Come and see. Encouraging investigation that doesn't have the spirit. Like it encourages us to investigate things, but it's more immediate than that. Come and see. Look. Wake up. Damn it. Don't be so stupid. Wake up. And encourage you to investigate your mental state right now. Or Upanayakatama, leading onward. Yeah, onwards of what? You know, that's a baffling one, leading onwards. Bhajatang Vaitidapo Nui, to be experienced individually by the wise. So then you think, well, I'm not wise yet, so I can't experience it individually or whatever. can interpret. Don't trust those the way you might hold those particular reflections. So like wisdom then isn't something, you know, like this is to see that wisdom is something that you don't have, you know, like in your way you might regard yourself, you think, I'm not wise, I don't have any wisdom. And so then if you believe that, if you really hold to that view, then of course you wisdom isn't going to operate in your practice, because you've already settled for the fact that you're not wise. And even if you have very stupid thoughts and silly emotions and very immature and all kinds of neurotic hang-ups, difficulties, fears and strange desires, if you identify with all that, that's not wisdom, is to identify with any of that. Because if once you identify with it, then you're grasping it, and then it becomes more than what it is. You're making it into something personal, very complicated, and it becomes increasingly more complicated. So this is where this trusting yourself is encouraged. Because even if you have foolish thoughts and immature emotions, the ability to acknowledge them, to welcome them, to allow whatever arises in consciousness, weird desires or whatever, energies or just confusion and hopelessness, despair, the attitude of welcoming, then this is my upaya, I find, helps me to, reminds me to accept the way it is, which is not personal. It's not saying, I'm this way, I just have to accept the way I am. It's not, that's something I'm adding, that it's mine, isn't it? That this funny feeling is mine. But this funny feeling is like this. So then this is where we are using wisdom. So I encourage you to just take it for granted. Wisdom is not something difficult or remote or that you lack or that somebody has more of than you do, but to recognize that it's natural to this human state. It's natural intelligence. It's universal wisdom that we begin to recognize when we let go of identifying with all the different conditions that we experience. And so this letting go is not resisting or getting rid of, but it's allowing, welcoming. Letting things, conditions be what they are. Because that's very direct, very honest practice. And whatever you're feeling right now, whether you like it or not, doesn't matter. It's the way it is. It's like this. And so in that, I find in that welcoming, embracing style, in I don't create a problem about it. When I remind, I don't always remember to do this, by the way, but certainly works when I do it. Works in a good way, because my relationship, it's how I hold it, how I allows me to be present and allow emotional states or memories, or they're quite painful or frightening or unwanted, allowing them to be what they are. My relationship to them is then of welcoming and allowing, rather than judging, controlling, and trying to get rid of my tendencies to get rid of things I don't like, emotions that I'm frightened of, or I don't want to be bothered with. Look at the way, in the tradition we're in, the Dhamma Vinaya, the Vinaya is another one. How we hold to discipline, just the word discipline. Morality, sila. And notice how when we read the Vinaya, how peremptory it is. You know, it's stated in very kind of, this is right, this is wrong, this is good, this is bad, just the style of Vinaya oftentimes affects us very strongly. I remember when I first began to understand what they were reading in the Vinaya readings in Thai, I used to come out just, you know, totally angry, really, because just the style, the way they read it, and the style it was presented in was so kind of, you know, black and white and imperative, you must and should, and this is good and this is bad. And so this very style, this way of presenting something brought in this sense of just incredible anxiety and guilt. And so that one held the Vinaya in a way that made one's life always very difficult. So afraid, so anxious, so worried, or guilt around keeping all these rules. So then on my sixth month I spent in a different monastery in Chonburi, Wat Kautilak, and there the teacher was even more kind of peremptory than they were at Wat Papo. And he developed Vinaya in a way that was, he was so absolute about it. And so when I told him about the Vinaya at Wat Papo, he looked down his nose and said, not very good Vinaya. And I was shocked, you know, because I'm very proud that we kept such a high standard of Vinaya. And then this monk said, seemed to consider it a bit inferior. And he added a lot more kind of precious rules and kind of fussy kind of rules around everything we did. So I became very critical of Wat Papo, because I was going by the standard that the more rules you keep and the more tight you hold all these rules, the better it is, you know, the kind of logic, you know, that if it's really strict, really, really strict, then it's better than a monastery that's not so strict. And of course, my conceit was I want to have the best. You know, I want to do things in the best way. And so that in monasteries that were lesser, you know, I wanted, you know, I could only feel they're not, my identity with them was somehow questioned, because I want the best, the most strict, the toughest, the highest. And then they talk about other monasteries that, you know, really, really strict. And it goes on and on, where, you know, you get into the mode that you're so uptight by the end of the day that you lose your sense of humor, and you just have to disrobe because you can't do it. So at the end of my sixth vasa, I noticed that most of the monks disrobed. The abbot and I were the only ones left. But then one learns from these situations, you know, that is strictness the answer, you know, asceticism, doing the sitter's practice, being vegetarian, very strict vegetarian, very strict vinaya, really hard practice, not giving in to any weakness, in any kind of laziness, anything lesser was considered, you know, you just suppressed all that out and trying to live to a very high standard. And one can do that for a while, but then after a while you can't. I couldn't sustain it. You can get high on being the best, being the, you know, the crack team, the Green Berets, For young men, this is a kind of pride in the outfit, and you kind of get very high on this kind of way of holding something. But it's not a way that you can sustain. You can't live your life like that. So then what do you do? Then it began to see, well, maybe I'm holding it the wrong way. What would the Buddha, if he's emphasizing awareness, mindfulness, what is he saying? This is the main point. He's not saying, in fact, in the Dutanga rules, isn't it? There's various ways of keeping Dutanga rules. And there's a kind of easy way, middle way, and tough way. Well, in my conditioning was, well, the tough way is the best. You do it the tough way or you don't do it at all. You don't do it the easy way, or the middle way, kind of compromise between easy and tough. You know, I'm going to do it the tough way, and so I would hold to the Dutanga rules in the toughest possible way. And then in Watpapo, in those days, they were really tough on some of them, like the. One, the practice of eating one meal a day from the alms bowl, so that if I happen to, accidentally have Ovaltine before, because Ovaltine is considered food, then that would be my meal for the day. I could not have the other meal. And it was even so that even if you didn't clean your teeth well enough after the meal and you still had particles of food remaining in your teeth, and in the afternoon you swallowed those particles of food, that means you had two meals a day. So this mindset was really quite, diligently cleaning my teeth after every meal, and this was around a Dutanga rule, not about Vinaya. So, of course, eating a meal in the afternoon, like swallowing a particle of food that was lodged between your teeth, that's breaking the Vinaya, eating in the afternoon. So now then you begin to observe, how does this affect you, this way of holding it? Is it leading to liberation or peace of mind? Is it leading to contentment? Or is it, do I think, it just makes me worry and anxious and uptight and makes, life very difficult, so I think I'd rather disrobe and take five precepts and you don't have all that problem. So one time Ajahn Chah told me the story of a monk. He said one of his monks years ago, I never met this one, but he was very strict with the Vinaya, but after a while he thought, well, it's too tough. I'm going to lower my rank, become Samanera. So he became Samanera, 10 precepts. He said, that's too difficult, 8 precepts. So he became Anagarika. And then, that's too tough, 5 precepts. And then gave up. One day he came back to the monastery of Sianjan. He says, I don't keep precepts anymore. And Ajahn Chah says, Sabai. Sabai, that means the Thai word for everything's just wonderful. So this obviously missed the point, isn't it? How to use precepts in a way that they help with mindfulness. So sometimes just the way we hold them is heedless, thinking that the way we grasp and hold and cling to rules, precepts, can be done heedlessly. And even when you're really tough and really, really at it, totally committed to morality and Vinaya, that can be an act of heedlessness, because you're not aware of what you're actually doing. You've committed yourself to something out of an idea. You're grasping the idea, an interpretation, an opinion. And you're not aware of that. You're not awake. You don't see what you're grasping. You just believe you're doing the right thing. And you're not questioning. You're not investigating the result of holding it or grasping in that way. So then then the challenge comes to all of us, and what to do, how to keep the Vinaya, respect the Vinaya, practice the Dhamma in the way that we're awake, we're aware of what we're doing, we're with the flow of the present, we're in the stream of the present. And that's something you have to trust in your own realization of it. Nobody can do that for you or tell you how to do it. The the key word is wake up, pay attention. Then this sense of welcoming, say, is also, welcoming is metta, isn't it? Welcoming and metta, unconditioned love, are the same thing, really. Because, you know, like metta practice, as oftentimes taught, is very abstract. You know, may I abide in well-being, and may everyone abide in well-being, and it's a formula that we can grasp at. And it can, you know, it's beautiful, even if you're grasping the formula. It's quite, you know, it's a generous and lovely thing to be grasping. But the reality of metta, what is metta practically at this moment? You know, what is it, that which accepts, does not judge, does not prefer, does not criticize. So, in those of you who have these jackals, using NVC jargon, have metta for jackals too. You know, so if you've got a strong kind of super ego that constantly criticizes and and tyrannizes you. Metta, you know, so you begin to allow even the most irritating tyrannical habits you have that might arise in consciousness. They all belong. You know, the metta is non-judgmental, non-critical. It's welcoming. It allows beings. So you can see even mental beings are the same as other beings. If you consider devadas and asuras and pretas and all these kind of beings that we have in our cosmology, they say, may all the pretas be free from suffering. But what are the pretas in terms of this moment, if there are any? Or the asuras, or the jackals, or the human, or the devas. So metta is allows us to embrace, to welcome, to accept the way it is. And it's not created, and so when we look at metta as all sentient beings, then look at your own emotional habits as sentient beings, not in some kind of personal way, some kind of personal problem that you have to resolve in some way. Then it becomes more than what it is. It's a sentient being. Is how I see it, anyway. So if I've got these tyrannical voices going off in my mind, or feelings of anger, resentment, or whatever, then these are very sentient beings. Then you're actually allowing, you're not. It's not an abstract sentient being like pretas and asuras and all that, as if something out there. You're actually right in the thick of it with them, not kind of abstract. May all asuras be free from suffering. when the asura inside you can't even you're trying to get rid of, trying to suppress. So then the avici hell and the different hell realms, the states of misery, stupidity, like the animal realm and the pretas and what they call the the upaya states. These are, you know, are they kind of, you know, the people ask me, does the preta realm really exist or not? You know, is that just, or do devadas really, are there real devadas, you know? Have you seen a deva, have you ever seen a deva? And they want to know if, you know, if, because I meditate, you know, I'm probably in touch with these different realms in some way. You know, and then some devas might appear, and an asura or a preta, and because of the strong samadhi that I've achieved. That's how they see it. But now, that doesn't work. And if you do see them, it doesn't, you know, what does it matter really? If you just see them as something, you know, if you realize, oh, I'm now in touch with the deva realms, and I have a hotline to the asuras, and I can travel all these 31 realms of existence, you know, at will. Or with the actual realities of your own conscious experience. Because if you put it in too personal a way, then it goes into our way of thinking about ourselves as judging it in some way. You know, like seeing it in terms of should or shouldn't, or a problem, or good or bad, strong or weak. So bringing it down to the practical place, the existential reality of the present, then learn from the way you are. What does appear and disappear in your conscious, in the present? And these, I found these labels quite helpful, you know, to recognize that this is archetypal energies and things that, you know, I certainly don't create. It's not like my personal creation. Because, you know, if I'd created, you know, when I was a child, if I'd created the world, it would have been a lot better world than the one that God created. Remember I told you when I was a little boy, why did God create pain? If I were God, I wouldn't have allowed pain. I'm more compassionate than God is. Or sickness and disease. You know, we had to go through the measles, the chicken pox, the rheumatic fever very badly as a child, and all kind of asthma. I was asthmatic for the first 14 years. And all these kind of nasty, you get a cold and the flu and pneumonia. And in those days, they didn't have antibiotics, you know, as a child. So, why did God create pneumonia? And so this is, you know, this is the mind of a child, you know, because I didn't want pneumonia or pain or disease. And who wants them? And if God loved us and really created a proper world for us to live in, he wouldn't have allowed such terrible things to happen. So this is the logic of a child's mind in terms of experience of pain and disease. But awakening then is recognizing that the conditioned realm, the world that we live in, and the world is your own is your conscious experience. Don't see the world as something out there that you know, the common attitude about the world. It's not. That's a perception of the world that we all agree to. You know, the real world is, you know, London and Paris and New York and on like this. And, you know, people working in the real world aren't sitting here, you know, meditating, watching their breath, going in and out, listening to the sound of silence. They're out, you know, really, you know, facing up to the real world. You know, you've got to be responsible and you've got to, you know, get to work and prove yourself and, you know, get married, have children, keep the species going, and, you know, get a good job, make money, buy a house, get a mortgage, have a car. Do all the right things according to the way our particular society views what the real world is. But recognize right now that view that I've just been reflecting on is a viewpoint, isn't it? If we all agree that the real world is like that, and say culturally, that's how I was brought up, to regard the real world was that. You know, world of responsibility, taking, you know, getting a job, getting education, getting a job, raising a family, proving yourself, being somebody, not being just a dropout or a slackard or a kind of tramp or homeless person or something like that. That was someone who couldn't face the real world. They were disgraceful and failures. The real world was the kind of out there, the yuppies, you know, really getting things together, making life work for them. But the real world, in terms of right now, is what? The reality, or what is the world right now? Without abstracting it into some kind of cultural attitude or memory that you might have, or perception or view you might have about the real world. What is the reality of the world for you at this present moment? And you know, so then you awaken, isn't it? You're opening to the way it is. You're not trying to create some idea of a real world or find what you might think is a real world, but the real world is like this. It's consciousness now, and the thing and the conditions that arise in consciousness now. So then we have this teaching, reflective teaching, itta bhajyata. So when the conditions for this come together for this, then this arises in consciousness. So it's like on a retreat, for example, where, say on a strict retreat, formal retreat, then the conditions are different than when we're not on retreat, or where it's more everyone, say, it's not a formal, quote, formal community retreat, unquote. It's where, say, for the past 6 weeks or so, you've been, you know, allowed a lot of freedom to practice on your own, as they say, whatever that means to you. Or even the word practice. You know, one can get into compulsive practice. Practice, practice, practice. Practice makes perfect. And not that, you know, that we shouldn't practice, but how do we hold these things? You know, what, and it's not to even criticize if you're an obsessed practitioner. But to be able to see it, to it's like this, to feel compulsive about practice is like this. You know, if you feel guilty if you don't sit so many hours a day or don't practice to the ideal, the high standard that you might hold, and then how do you feel? And then you can begin to recognize the way one's grasping very good ideas or very good advice, very good teachings. So this, when the conditions arise, then this is experienced in consciousness. So like when I've talked many times about facing the Buddha shrine, the conditions are different than when I'm sitting facing one of you or the group. And so in terms of itabhajjata, you know, the Buddha Rupa, that Buddha Rupa I'm very fond of that Buddha Rupa because I helped design it and went and saw the whole thing being made. And went through from the beginning, from the design phase to the casting and then the final when we lifted it up onto the stand. And then how I can look at, I remember looking at Buddha Rupas as intimidating objects. You know, looking up at the Buddha Rupa and so calm and serene. And then I kept remembering these things in the Pali Canon where it says, foolish monk. So I sit down there and I think of the Buddha Rupa and he's probably saying, foolish monk. Or, because I tend to see, maybe I feel intimidated by a Buddha Rupa. I feel I'm being criticized or being judged in some way by the Buddha. Or changing that from this kind of judge that says foolish monk to blessing. You know, that's a sign of blessing. This is the mudra is blessing. So he's not saying foolish monk, he's saying bless you, Sumedho. Every time. You are being blessed. Now that makes it much more pleasant than the sitting facing the Buddha Rupa. You get revived every time. You look up and you're kind of being blessed by this Rupa all the time, you know. Look up there. If I look up there and think, foolish monk, Sumedho. And it's how it's up to me how I want to use the moment, isn't it? What helps you for the Buddha Rupa to say, foolish monk, or bless, I love you, bless you. So this is up to you how you want to interpret it, what you want to project onto that Buddha Rupa, because it's not a conscious being. It's a rupa. But then I turn around and face you, and then it's not the same, is it? The conditions have changed from bless you, Sumedho, to somebody who's probably, you don't know what they're thinking. I'm thinking, foolish monk, or bless you, Sumedho. Are you blessing me, or am I blessing you, what do you think when I'm sitting here, and I don't know what you're thinking. Look at the body language and. Some people, you know, fall asleep. Other people get up and walk out, and they might have to go to the toilet. But then I think I probably have offended them in some way. Or, I mean, you could make a problem out of almost anything. So who makes the problem? Who creates the problem? Who's creating this world? It's easy to imagine what others are thinking about me. So, and if I'm not welcoming even my own paranoid projections or whatever, then it becomes very complicated. It becomes difficult to be with others, to be head of a community or anything like that, because everything is too complicated and difficult. Like some people like strict practice, you know, absolute silence, no mucking about, get up at 3 a.m, go to bed at 11 p.m, walk slowly all the time, and some people would say, oh, wonderful. That was a real, real retreat, Ajahn Sumedho. And others would say, oh, I just, you know, absolute hell. I'm never going to do that again. So in the techniques, the forms, the conditions, the path is not something remote or you get at the end of a strict retreat. The path is right now. What is the path right now then? If the Eightfold Path, Nibbana right now, and if you try to conceive it, doesn't work, does it? Because your mind just gets caught in what you've read in the Pali Canon or in Mahayana texts or in what other people have said, various strong views you hold about it, about yourself, about how high and wonderful it must be, how remote it is from you, and all the defilements and kilesas you have that prevent you from probably in this lifetime to ever achieve nibbana. But just awaken to that, welcoming that, even your conceptual proliferating habits, is establishing the path if you trust it. So it's not something remote, it's here and now. And it's not difficult. It's not something that takes a tremendous kind of skills. It takes faith or trust in this willingness and welcoming attitude to the world that you're experiencing. And then that's bhajjatang. You can only do that yourself. Nobody can make you do that. Like a strict Zen master could make you get up at 3 a.m. and go to bed 11 p.m. and make you keep quiet all the time. As soon as you start nodding off, hit you with a stick. But nibbana is here and now. It's not. Even when you're asleep. So see it in terms of not creating the path into some complicated thing that you can't do, but trusting in even if you feel totally confused by what I'm saying, to know that confusion, to accept the despair or confusion that you might be feeling at this moment. This welcoming, embracing, allowing. And somebody will say, you're a Dzogchen master, Ajahn Sumedho. they want to put or your Mahayana or things like this, because you know, is this really a Theravadan teaching? You know, is this proper according to the orthodox Theravadan view? And so then you get into the academic groups that have strong views about it. But these are views, isn't it? Like feelings of questioning, doubting, because it doesn't agree with maybe your perception of Theravada. Or and because it doesn't, then you conceive it as Mahayana. Or these are just words, aren't they? Concepts that we've acquired. Without any concepts, what's left? You know, so then the awareness is, it doesn't depend on conceiving anything. And so this is whether you have, the right word or the right concept to apply to what you're feeling, this is important because it's the way it is. It's like this. It's not, you don't have to put a name to it or describe it, because you know it directly. It's like this. If you feel numb or stupid or confused, it's like this. And then this attitude of welcoming, of metta, helps for my practice, helps me, reminds me too. I don't have to do anything with it. I can allow whatever I'm feeling to be, to exist in its own right. So then in consciousness, this way of recognizing, this like sound of silence, helps you, is a way of beginning to recognize what just pure consciousness is. You're not grasping the conditions in consciousness. It allows consciousness to experience consciousness in this present moment, in which you can allow the conditions. So in this way, you're using consciousness and wisdom together, panya and vijnana. Panya is informing consciousness. So panya is wisdom. It's a natural wisdom. It's not an acquired kind of wisdom or knowledge. And this is where trusting it, you don't even have to have words. You don't have to even think wise thoughts. Just trust in the immediacy and the presence of wisdom, because it's your true nature. It's not something that you don't have and you've got to get or get more of. It's the wisdom, you begin to trust. Wisdom and faith then are together. Satta and panya are, the same thing, really. They're one supporting the other. They support each other. So, on the 11th, we could begin on the morning puja of the 11th. Is that right? Raja? Is that all right? just to start out the 11th, on that note of morning puja. And then during this two-week retreat, I thought maybe in the evenings it would be nice to invite some of the monks and nuns to expound. Give Dhamma, or, you know, share what they've learned, or give Dhamma reflections.